Book Friends Forever, Episode 8. Hi, I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lin.
And we're Book Friends Forever.
We're childhood friends that grew up to be...
a children's book editor.
And an author and illustrator.
Welcome to Episode 8. Hard to believe we're already at Episode 8. Every week, we catch up on each other's lives, talk about what's on our minds, take a trip down memory lane, and share with each other what we're grateful for.
Also, please subscribe to our podcast if you haven't already, and we'd appreciate you rating us on iTunes and leaving us a good review.
So we know last week's episode was pretty sad, so thank you for listening and going on this journey with us. But let's talk about this week. Grace, how has your week been?
It's been kind of crazy and busy. I'm starting my school visit schedule again, and so I've been traveling. I just flew back from Traverse City, Michigan, and where we did this Battle of the Books thing with my books. It was really fun. It was really exciting. But
Who won? Are you allowed to say?
The Battle of the Books, it's not between books. It's like these two teams. These are the finalists that I saw, these two teams. And basically, there's like six or seven books that they have to read, and they have to read it really well. And they ask all these questions about the books, and whoever gets the most questions right wins. And so they are asking all these really detailed questions. And of course, one of the books that they had to read was mine. And they were asking all these detailed questions about my own book. And I swear, I didn't know the answer.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I don't know. What color were the flowers? And it was so funny because it's like my own book and like they knew it better than I did.
Yeah, that happens. When Chris Colfer goes on tour, they have a trivia and I don't know most of the answers. But all the kids do. That's what counts.
Yeah. And it was just so nice because they were so enthusiastic and so excited about the books. And, you know, it's just really fun to be in that kind of atmosphere where kids just love books so much.
Yeah, that's great.
But how was your week?
Well, I had my little brother and his family visiting. So my little brother, Ben, who I found out listens to this podcast. So hi, Ben.
Hi, Ben.
And Iris. Hi, Ben and Iris and Shoshana and Bryson. So Shoshana and Bryson are my niece and nephew, and they're 4 and almost 2. And so they're just at really fun ages. And, you know, we had good food. We went to the Brooklyn Children's Museum. So it was just really fun. I did not really edit hardly at all this weekend, but that's okay because, you know, talking about work-life balance, it was family time. So it was really nice to have them in my apartment and hear laughing children who are chasing my cat around and terrorizing her.
Poor cat.
But they eventually learned. I said, you know, if you chase her around, she's not going to like you and she's going to run away. So just be quiet and gentle. And so at least Shoshana was able to do that. Bryson was still just kind of grabbing for him, but that's okay. I had a really nice weekend. So I thought we would do a quick follow-up on last week's episode since it was a little heavy. And so our trip down memory lane, I thought we could talk about some of the things we did to grieve and to cope after our husbands died. So Grace, do you want to tell us, do you remember what you did that really helped you recover after Robert died?
When we were talking about the whole grieving process and Robert's death, I think I mentioned Where the Mountain Meets the Moon. One of the things that I did to cope while we were fighting his cancer, or how we both coped, was I would write stories, and then while he was sleeping, which, you know, there's a lot of time sleeping when someone is going through chemotherapy and being ill like this, I would write stories, and then when he woke up, I would read the stories to him, and we would talk about it, and he used to be really excited and tell me what he thought and add his ideas and things like that. And so during his last battle, I was starting to write Where the Mountain Meets the Moon, or what was to become Where the Mountain Meets the Moon. And as I mentioned in the last episode, he died before I finished that book. And I remember thinking, I know I mentioned this last episode, I remember thinking that now that he was no longer here, I was not going to be able to finish the book. I was just said, okay, it's done. I can't finish it. And I thought, I'm not going to write it ever. And I remember meeting one of my friends, Janet Wong, after Robert died. And she said, oh, what are you working on? And I told her about the book. And I said, well, but now I can't write it because he's gone. And she's like, no. It's better this way, because if you had finished it before he had died, you would feel like you couldn't change anything. This way, you can write your own ending. When she said that, it was like this kind of this, you know, Oprah calls it this light bulb moment, which is kind of cheesy, but it really was, because I kind of felt like, oh, I can write my own ending. And that kind of was like this symbol of my life, like, oh, I can write my own ending to my life, you know? It's not tied down to what we had planned. It's a whole open, it's a whole open book now, you know? And because she said that, I started writing, and writing Where the Mountain Meets the Moon, finishing it. And really, it kind of became a real solace to me, putting all the things that I feel like Robert's death and his illness taught me in that book. And so Where the Mountain Meets the Moon actually became a real kind of healing project for me. So I'm so glad when people read it and they get so much out of it, because that's really what it was for me as well.
Oh, that's nice.
So what were some of the things you did to cope?
Well, I guess mine are more common things, but I did start therapy. And for me, I had done therapy once before for maybe like 4 weeks. And my therapist at one point said, you don't actually need me. And I said, you know, you're right. So I think in this case, I went to therapy mainly to get over the trauma of Greg's actual death. As I mentioned, like, we had gone through all the stages of grief before he died. But I think I wasn't prepared for how traumatic and, I don't know, in Greg's case, kind of messy his actual death was, and it just haunted me. So I went into therapy, but actually very quickly, I think after two sessions, I kind of moved on from that, and it was more, I don't know, like the everyday stuff. Like, I don't know, I had really bad insomnia, and I still kind of battle with insomnia. So it was like, you know, figuring out how I can sleep. And I think what really helped was focusing on the present. I had read that in some book or blog that, you know, when you're washing dishes, you just focus on, I am washing dishes right now, and it kind of helps. And then I think for me, the hardest part was battling loneliness, because I had never lived alone my whole adult life until then. So I'd always had roommates, or I lived with a partner, and then I lived with Greg. So after Greg died, that was the first time I lived by myself. And so I'm really happy that I had Venus, at least, so I wasn't actually living by myself. I had a cat. But I actually started doing a lot of the routines that I mentioned in an earlier podcast, where, you know, that's when I started on Thursday nights. A friend and an author that I work with, Lev Rosen, and his partner, Chris Shoemaker, they had another mutual friend over every Thursday to watch RuPaul's Drag Race, and they'd cook dinner. And so they had invited me, you know, a couple, like maybe a year or two before, and I had never gone because Greg was sick. But after Greg died, I actually asked, I basically invited myself, and I said, hey, does that invite still stand? I'd love to start coming. So I'm still doing that, you know, almost 3 years later, and that's really nice. So I started doing all my kind of weekly, to have these kind of weekly plans, so to have a routine. So those are the things.
That's nice. That's nice. It's like a community.
Yeah, and I recommend that for anybody. It's just a nice thing to have. For our next On Our Minds segment, Grace, you have something on your mind, right?
Yes, well, actually, we received our first suggestion for a topic on Facebook. I belong to all these different Facebook groups, and I said, hey, I started this podcast with Alvina. Does anybody have any things that you'd like us to talk about? And someone wrote in a suggestion, and the suggestion was, one area I think I'd love to hear about more is the notion of the publishing quota, the idea that there can only be one story by, enter marginalized group here, per imprint, say. I know that lots of people of color authors and even agents have shared stories with me about being told, essentially, we already have a similar story to yours, or your book is too close to story X by another publisher. We can have dozens of books about white kids going on road trips, but can you even imagine like two or three or with, say, South Asian kids? So I think this is a really interesting topic, this idea of there can only be one. It's something that has kind of always haunted me that throughout my whole career, and something that only in the last couple of years that I've tried to like loosen those shackles, because the idea that you can only have like one Asian author at a publishing house, one Black author at a publishing house.
Like, when do you feel like you just, it's because of you just always had heard stories about that happening? Or like, when did that first enter your consciousness of that this was possibly an issue?
I think it was an issue 20 years ago, for sure. Meeting editors who say, oh, I like your stuff, but I already got an Asian guy, so I don't need you. You know, like, I think it was a definitely true thing 20 years ago when I started. And the idea that there would only be like one Asian book per season, you know, like, or one Black book per season.
It's so interesting because I've heard the stories, and I think this is why it's important to have more diverse editors and agents, for example, because in my mind that never occurred to me, you know, and my goal when I became an editor was just to acquire as many authors, you know, underrepresented authors and characters as I could. And, so just to be transparent, like, I definitely didn't have a quota. I was just responding to the books that I was reading. But I think that, you know, that pool was limited because I think agents were perhaps not seeking out those stories. If you look at my list, I work with so many Asian American and Asian, you know, Taiwanese as well, authors and illustrators. And I never had a problem acquiring them, you know, at Little Brown, so.
Well, I think it was really interesting because we've talked about this, how I didn't work with you until pretty, at least 10 years into my career, right? And mm-hmm. I remember we had already published The Year of the Dog, maybe we'd published The Year of the Rat, and Jenny Han was writing her very first middle grade, and you asked me if I wanted to blurb it. And mm-hmm. I remember freaking out. I was like, oh no, you've got Jenny Han on your list now. There's like, she's gonna take my place. I was so convinced that if her book was more successful, she would be the Asian author and I would be gone. And I was like, oh no.
I find it so sad that you would think that about me as your editor and also your best friend, that I would be like, I'm publishing Jenny Han now. Goodbye.
There's so many things out of your control. I wouldn't have held it against you personally. I just would have been like her.
No, I know, but it's a little sad that you thought that was what was going to happen. And Jenny Han and I had been friendly, and we'd been wanting to work together. And so, yeah, she wrote her first middle grade called Clara Lee and the Apple Pie Dream. I do remember when I sent it to you, Grace, that you seemed weird about it. I don't think you admitted your feelings this specifically until years later. But I do remember you acted a little weird about it, and you said something to me like, you know, like, I had originally envisioned Year of the Dog to be more like Clara Lee in terms of the age grade group. I mean, they're both middle grade, but Clara Lee felt a little more like chapter booky, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I do remember feeling like it was a little odd that you seemed reluctant. And I, you know, because you also knew Jenny, and you know, like, from my point of view is that we want all of these books to succeed. And also, Jenny is Korean-American, and you're, you know, Taiwanese-Chinese-American, and they're very different stories and different voices. It, you know, to me, they're not similar, really.
Actually, it was you who kind of set me straight on that, because I remember I freaked out, and I didn't want to blurb it, right? And I think... I think maybe like a month or so later, you're like, oh, are you going to blurb it? And then I think I finally admitted to you. And I was like, well, I'm honestly a little scared because I feel like if Jenny's book takes off, you know, I'll be replaced. And I think you kind of laughed and you're like, what? And I think you said, I think there's enough room to have more than one Asian author at Little Brown and in the world. I think you actually said this. And I think when you said that, all of a sudden, this house of cards that I had built kind of like collapsed. And I was like, oh my gosh, you're right. I was really ashamed. I remember feeling like, oh my gosh, all this time I'm talking about diversity, all these things, and yet I cannot bring it upon myself to like support another Asian author because I'm so worried about my own place. Like, I did blurb the book, I just want to admit. like I did do the right thing. I want people to know I'm admitting to my selfishness and my failings as as an author. But in the end, I did do the right thing and I did blurb the book and it did really well. And of course, Jenny is like a rock star now. So it's not
She's
like
a superstar.
Yeah. So it's not like even if I hadn't blurbed the book, I don't think it would have made a difference. But
yeah, I mean, I did want to speak to, though, the fact there are no official quotas. I mean, and there are no official quotas, as far as I know, at any publisher for specific types of books. I mean, like, for I'll give you an example that's not race related, but you know, like, we would ideally love to have at least a book a year that is, say, a Christmas, you know, holiday book or a Valentine's book. But even though that's what we want, we do have some winter seasons that go where we don't have a Christmas book, you know, so that's something that we actually kind of want and are looking for. But it's so hard. It's hard to fill quotas also, no matter what they are. I, you know, honestly, if editors and agents had quotas, we would have way more books by and about characters of color, because, I mean, it would be awesome if every single publisher had an Asian book, a Black book, a Latinx book, a LGBTQ book on every single season, but that's not the case. So there's still just not enough books, at least now that people are actively looking for diverse books. I don't think editors are, and I know that they have in the past, but now I don't feel like editors are saying, oh, I already have my Asian book. I will say we have in the past said, oh, you know, like, for example, when we published Twilight, we did not acquire another vampire book. And of course, there are so many vampire books out there. But we published Cirque de Freak first, and then we published Twilight. And we said, you know what, we don't want to compete against ourselves. And so therefore, we're not going to acquire any other vampire books. So things like that are said. So yeah, if we had a road trip book, no matter what the race of the characters were, we might not want to acquire another one for that same season. But if we fell in love with one, we would still want to acquire it, but we would put it on a different season to kind of separate out the books. So again, I've only ever worked at Little Brown, so I can't speak to other publishers. I think if it is happening, it's almost unconscious, subconscious. And so I do think it probably is happening out there, but not in a very conscious, like, you know, calculated way, if that makes sense.
Like I said, as an author, I can't really say it with certainty, but it sure feels like it is, you know, and if maybe it's not that they're saying this is my Asian author and this is my Black author, this is my, but it really feels like it is. And I feel like maybe it is subconscious because that's the way it's always been done.
Right. But if you look at Bolton and Bray, like, they publish Angie Thomas, they publish Justina Ireland. I feel like if authors actually looked at publishers' lists, certain publishers, I think, who maybe are better known for publishing diverse stories, I think you'll see more. Like, I'll give an example. So next spring, I'm publishing a second book by Emily Pan, and I'm also publishing a book by I.W. Gregorio. They're both Taiwanese-American YA authors, and they're both writing romance, you know, YA romances, and we're publishing in the same season, you know. And again, I do feel like in the past it was a real problem, but I don't feel like it's as bad a problem now.
I would agree with that for sure. I would say that it's definitely changing, and I would agree that I feel like it's a lot less of a problem now, of only because, like you said, I think a lot of it might have been subconscious in editors' and agents' minds, because that's, like I said, that was the way it was kind of always done. And now with We Need Diverse Books and everybody, with diversity being such on people's minds, it's something that editors and agents have started to question, and they realize, oh, wait, we can have more than one.
I mean, well, actually, this is somewhat related, but, I think this relates to needing more people of color on the publishing side. So when I remember, this was over 10 years ago, I was hiring for an assistant, and one of the top, actually two of the three top candidates happened to be Asian women. And I remember just feeling a little bit of a feeling like, oh, what would the optics be if myself as an Asian woman hired another Asian woman? Would people feel like I'm biased towards Asian women? And then I realized, oh my gosh, like white people don't have to worry about this. Like if you're a white person and you hire another white person, it's like that's just what happens.
Uh-huh.
So that was when I hired Connie Hsu, who is a superstar, and you know, she's now an executive editor at Roaring Brook. But yes, I mean, I think, like, when it comes to acquiring books, though, I kind of felt like, you know what, I'm an Asian American editor. I want to acquire Asian American stories. And I did, and I think because I'm Asian, like, at our acquisitions meeting, people are not going to say, oh, you know what, you already have an Asian American story on your list. Are you sure you want to acquire another one? Like, no one was going to say that to my face, and I honestly don't know if anyone ever thought that because they never voiced it. So I do feel like I was able to do that because of who I am. And that's why we need, you know, we need more diversity on the editorial side and sales side and just everything. But I guess that's another whole topic that we could talk about forever.
I think that's true. And I mean, and that, I mean, as the author, on the other side, I think that also feeds into what I was confessing to, this idea, like, I think we've always been of the scarcity mindset, especially people of color authors, because we've always thought there can only be one. And then when you fight so hard to be that quote unquote one, you're always afraid that you have to like fight for your place. And that's just not a healthy way to have a career or to build a community or to foster more diversity. Yeah. Like, it's just a terrible, terrible way to like be like this pigeon pecking away, like pecking for your territory. I remember talking to Samira Ahmed about it, and she was saying like that's colonialism, like where you fight, they want the minorities to fight amongst themselves so they can still stay dominant, you know? And I was like, that is so true. And it's almost, for me, it's been almost like a forcible re-education for myself, like because my gut always acts from a place of fear, like, oh, and I have to almost like take a step back and say, no, do you believe in fostering more diversity in publishing or not? And like, and you put that selfish fear away and you try to like help the next person, you know, like it's really an interesting thing that we've kind of created.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that does come from living in a racist society. I think it's hard for all of that to not kind of, you know, be within our subconscious and sometimes consciousness.
Yeah.
So yes, but I think we all have to do what we can. And again, I wish every publisher had their Asian author. I don't think they do. That's the thing. I mean, obviously I want, you know, them to have more than one, but I don't know. I really wonder if, like, if every imprint at every publisher had their Asian author, then we would have way more books being published by Asian authors than we do now. So,
yeah.
You know, but anyway, there is room for sure. And but I think it's just something we all have to work on. And I'll just put it out there for any editors and publishers listening. It's like, if you just, you know, I guess explore your own biases and think about, do I reject books because, oh, I already have a book that's like this. I don't need this voice on my list. Because I really feel like you need to base it on the book. You fall in love with the book, and then you just figure out a way to publish it, and figure out a way to make it stand out on your list. And that could mean, you know, putting it on, spreading books out on different seasons potentially, but it doesn't mean not acquiring that author or that book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. The one example I do remember is, it wasn't me personally, but another editor had a submission, and it was an African American girl who started a cupcake business. And we published Sherry Winston, President of the Whole Sixth Grade, which is about an African American girl who starts a cupcake business. And so for us, that was just way too similar. I mean, if it were a white girl or an Asian girl starting a cupcake business, I don't think it would have been the same thing. We would have said, oh, well, we have a book that's like that. It was more plot similarity rather than, oh, we already have a black author writing in middle grade. Like, that wasn't the reasoning. It was the plot was too similar. Mm-hmm. But I guess that does, you know, so yes, if there is a road trip book, you know, we don't publish multiple road trip books, but with white characters on a season. So there is some thinking about, you know, making sure that you're not publishing books that are too similar on the same season, mm-hmm. Regardless of the, you know, the characters.
Maybe.
But there have been also the argument of like, well, if we don't publish it, another publisher is going to publish it, and we'll be still competing against that mm-hmm. book. So I know in the past, like we bid on Marie Lu's Legend series, and we ended up being the underbidder. And one of the reasons, I mean, sure, there are many reasons, but I remember one reason that they ended up going with another publisher was that we did not want to publish her book in the fall because we had another big fantasy book in the mm-hmm. fall that was, you know, and it was very different, but it was like just, you know, so you do take into account resources and, you know, not wanting to compete against ourselves because we're afraid that if our sales rep goes to Barnes & Noble and presents these two big fantasy series, Barnes & Noble might say, you know what, I'm just going to take this mm-hmm. one. But I feel like we changed that reasoning because we realized, no, like, now we're not publishing Marie Lu and now we're competing against her, mm-hmm. you know. So anyway, so I feel like a lot of the reasoning and thinking shifts over time.
So do you think that it goes for the problem might be even beyond publishing and goes all the way to like booksellers and gatekeepers where they're like, oh, we'll only take, I already have my African American title this fall. I only need one. Like
possibly. I mean, yeah, I do think, again, since we live in a racist society. It's hard to say. Again, like I feel like my Asian American friends, of course, they're looking for a lot of Asian American mm-hmm. books for their children, right? So they don't have a quota, but I guess I could see a bookseller or a, like they might just say, you know what, we love Graceland, and you know, Graceland is all we need. So they might, I don't know, possibly. We should ask some booksellers.
I know, someday we should ask a bookseller. But I think it's interesting because I can completely understand limiting it by subject matter like road trips. We are vampires, you know. But when we limit it by race, it becomes such a dicey thing because it makes it seem like the people who are interested in it are only interested in it because of race, which is so limiting and it's so hard for an author. And I think it really underestimates the reader too. And I also think it kind of teaches the reader these kind of biases when we start doing that too, especially the young mm-hmm. readers. So it's kind of a dangerous thing.
Very true. Well, if you have any thoughts out there on this topic, feel free to tweet us or post on Facebook.
Yeah, and if you have any other topics, too. If you have any other topics that you'd like us to talk about, we're happy to discuss them.
Yes, very much so. We'll end as we do every week with what we're grateful for. Grace, what are you grateful for this week?
Okay, so what I'm grateful for is I did not finish my novel for the deadline, but I got enough of it done that I had something to send in. And the only way I was able to do that, to actually have something to be able to send in, was by doing that retreat at the Highlights Foundation. So I'm very, very grateful to that retreat place at the Highlights. They're not paying me to say this. They're not a sponsor or anything like that. But if you ever need a place to work as an author where you need no distractions and you just want to write and write and your meals are taken care of, like, the Highlights Retreat place is amazing. It works magic for authors, I think. So if you are struggling with something, I really suggest you go there and do an unworkshop, they're called.
Yeah, it's a beautiful location. I've done some conferences there, and so I recommend it as well.
Okay, and what are you grateful for?
Well, going back to my family visiting. So I'm grateful for my niece and nephews. Actually, this was another thing that I went into therapy for. We talk about loss, and this is another topic for another time, but there's something called secondary loss that happens. And so for me, it was kind of the loss of having my own children. Mm-hmm. And not that it's, you know, off the table forever, but I kind of came to terms with the fact that it's probably not in the cards for me to have my own children. And my therapist said, you know, like, just focus on the children in your lives. And I'm so grateful that I have one niece and three nephews. And, you know, and now they're getting older, so I can have relationships with them. So I'm really grateful for the children in my life, and specifically my niece and my nephews.
Aww.
Thank you for joining us. You can find me at Planet Alvina on Twitter and at Alvina Ling on Instagram.
And I'm at Pacey Lynn on both platforms.
And please remember to rate and review us on iTunes. I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lynn.
Have a great week.
And happy reading.
Bye.